Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Whenever I look at the rich colours in the paintings by Matisse, I think of food. This all came about because of a book I read about the early life of Matisse. At the start of it, I got the usual description of how the artist strays from his day job, is considered by society to be an oddity or even an outcast, like Van Gogh, becomes the poor delusional man who thinks that his life will be fulfilled if he sticks to his inner convictions and dreams. I'd been yawning over these pages written by yet another gently outraged art critic, describing the difficult task of Maître Matisse at the start of his utterly successful life. He lived in his atelier and needed to keep the stove burning, and he needed to keep his models warm as they tended to pose in the nude. His wife as well, of course, needed to be comfy, and they needed to eat. Not just any old food, but good French food, the kind they were used to in the countryside where he came from. Matisse sought help from his family, who loved him dearly and admired his courage and work. He used to stand amidst his greens, reds, and blues and dictate a list to his wife. And don't forget to get a couple of cheeses, Bourceau, at least a month old, he could have said, while adding a joyous streak of yellow. Ah, yes, and sausages. Here is where I started to get interested. A detailed description follows of Matisse's maman and cousins arriving at the door of his Parisian atelier with the provisions for the family, models, and friends. The sturdy cousins carried wood up the narrow stairs. Bottles of wine and olive oil were stacked away behind the larger canvases. Cheeses, vegetables, and carefully wrapped meats were left in a storage place on the balcony. And so Matisse could submerge himself completely in his work on a well-filled stomach. The models grew languorous with deep red wine. The children danced around after the dinner, and I imagined I could see the whole circle of life in the colours in his works. When I moved to Ireland, also a struggling artist, though in a different vein than the great painter, I put some reproductions of his works on my walls and was again struck by the joie de vivre in his work. I had left behind a very small parcel of what was left of my family and needed to learn all about the joys of the new ground I lived on and what it would feed me so I could enjoy the life of Ireland. Soon, I met with a couple who lived in the nearby countryside, who had a hospitable home and a large herb and vegetable garden. I had a view, to be sure, but no garden at all. Slowly, I developed a small Matisse-like habit. It all started with flowers. Flowers cheered me up and distracted me from the impenetrable mists of this country. My friends picked them from their garden for me, and my vases were filled. Then it started to get worse. My food started to taste bland without the herbs they grew, and I would be on the phone claiming my work was getting dull from lack of country spices. So it was the strong-smelling onions, nourished by my friends with tender love, that started coming my way. After feeling duly inspired to do more work when I had fed on one of my onion tarts, I lost all sense of boundaries and simply started demanding greens by the bucketful. My friend would drive up, park, and we would haul the baskets of giant courgette and squash upstairs. Does this make me some kind of Matisse? I'm afraid not. I could only feed off the shadow of his monumental talent. And for me, colours only exist in my head and in my music. abstract ones, that is. Short of family, I loved the way my friends understood how much I enjoyed and needed their gifts of garden products. Some were so great to look at, I would put them on display in a colourful bowl, and new roots started to grow in my life and work.
My father, Matty Power, was a Kilkenny hurler in the 1920s and 30s and had 5 All-Ireland medals, 4 with Kilkenny and 1 with Dublin, and won 12 Leinster titles. There were 2 Railway Cups and county medals, just 1 with Kilkenny for Dixborough in 1923, but then another 6 with Garda GAA Club in Dublin. It all sounds fairly legendary to me. I can look up the statistics and relate them to you here. But when it comes to the medals, the story is more complicated. Legend has it that as a baby, I played on the floor with a key ring strung with them, providing a soothing, teething ring for me. My father proved himself generous in giving them away. One way or the other, many of them are no longer in the possession of this family. About the Tailteann Games medal he had, I know nothing, not even the year he won it. It seems that no record exists of who won what during the revival of the ancient games. No more than the games themselves, there are facts and then there are the legends. In my mind's eye, I can see the medal among his depleted collection. I don't know who thought it would be a good idea to put a Tailteann Games medal on a charm bracelet, but that's what happened to that one. The medal is lost and it seems gone forever. But it is proof that my father took part in the modern version of the games, in either 1924, 1928 or 1932. The legend of the ancient Irish funeral games, in honour of Queen Tailte, with all their attendant myths, was adapted to the 20th century in an attempt to rival the Olympics by the newly formed Irish Free State. Some scholars could throw cold water on the much-loved idea that long before the Greeks had thought of the Olympics, the physically strong and brave Irish were competing in the Éineadh Tailteann in hurling, athletics, stone throwing, horse racing, wrestling and many other pursuits. Then, proving that we do not live by brawn alone, there were competitions for poetry, song, music, painting and storytelling alongside the sport. The revival of the modern games is credited to J.J. Walsh. He was the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs in the Cumannagale government of the 1920s. There is less mention of Anne Gifford Wilson, who acted as secretary. It was one of the first decisions of the new Free State government to revive the games. The idea was to launch Ireland onto the world stage as a new and emerging nation, recovering from the War of Independence and open for business and innovation. The Civil War in 1922 put paid to the holding of the games that year. But by 1924, J.J. Walsh, with great imagination and vision, and seemingly a persistence that was of gold medal standard, had extracted funding from the government for the staging of the games, and another £10,000 for the renovation of Croke Park as the main venue for them, where the Hogan Stand was built for the occasion. They took place directly after the Paris Olympics, and sportspeople of the Irish diaspora came home to compete, as did sundry Olympians of other nationalities. The personification of this was when Romanian Johnny Weismuller competed in the swimming and water polo competitions. I can only imagine what those who saw or read about him competing in the murky waters of Dublin's Zoological Gardens had to say when they next saw him on the silver screen in the 1932 Hollywood film Tarzan the Ape Man. The games gave the nod to the legend that the High King Lugh held the original Tailteann Games, or Éineadh Tailteann, in 632 BC in homage to Queen Tolche, his stepmother. They continued intermittently for more than 1,000 years until the Norman invasion of 1169. The modern opening ceremony was Olympic-like, with each team parading with its flag, while actors dressed as Gaelic warriors and Queen Tolche, also known as Dublin actress Nancy Rock, paraded complete with Irish wolfhounds, spears and shields. The competitions included chess, billiards, clay pigeon shooting, motorcycle racing, car racing and even an aeroplane race, the logistics of which must have been complicated. As for me and my father's participation, well, that's just one of the many episodes of his life of which I knew nothing until after his death. But now, 100 years after the first modern games, when I see that grainy footage from Pathé News, I search the faces for one that might be familiar, looking for my own legend. The lesson is, if you have a father, talk to him. You'd never know what he was up to before you came along.
Pourquoi le chat? Pourquoi? A large guardian of the library, confined to his Parisian apartments and fed there, on kibbles and pâté. I held him and he felt like a baby in my arms. Maxou, the cat of Anne Françoise, successor of Capucine, who died suddenly and without explanation, one afternoon after having his breakfast. Her husband cared, but not too much. The interior defecation and occasional rivalry with Osiris, their daughter's cat, fatigued him. Pourquoi le chat? Pourquoi? Pourquoi le chat? Pourquoi? I wrote my doctorate in that apartment, in that library, in that same library which contained all the books I was referencing, but was also where the books I was referencing had been written. I had become my mentor's cat sitter, taking care of the apartment and of Maxou, while Anne Françoise and François toured America. François Laruelle and Anne Françoise Schmidt have spent their lives dedicated to a philosophical project they call non-philosophy, something you do rather than something that you learn by rote. To them, doing philosophy is more than the learning of the history of philosophy. They seek to put philosophy to work, like all things worth knowing. And for its histories, for the work of previous philosophers, to be used as tools in the making of new ideas for a new time. At the core of this approach is what they call a democracy of thought, a space in which philosophy is equal to other forms of knowledge, particularly that of art and music and science. In France, I was a double foreigner. My Irishness evident in the Dublin accent in which I spoke French, my blackness hidden, but present in the way I understood and navigated the city, my interests in the places I saw as important, such as Présence Africaine, a beautiful bookshop in the Latin Quarter, or Gojo, the Ethiopian restaurant beside the Pantheon. I would walk to these places, browsing, sitting, eating, thinking. In France, there is still space for that. Space to just be and think. In France, this is also understood to be an important type of work. I walked in Père Lachaise Cemetery, amongst the tombstones and the trees, a quiet, still place, reading names and imagining descendants, family resemblances, legacies and lines of succession. Looking at gravestones, renditions in stone, an urn with a veil draped over it. The veil of time hanging from stone wrists, lifted to reveal hands so delicately holding one another. faces turned upwards, stretching, mournful, like mannerist figures looking upwards through veils of stone, remembering. I also did a lot of remembering here. The ordinary kind that couples with loss and overthinking. Wondering why another person did what they did. Trying to remember every detail to maybe find a clue. A reason as to why. So I could integrate it and things could be okay again. It had taken months to process a bad breakup. These cemetery walks and being alone and working and writing and only Maxu in the evening had helped me patch things slowly back together. Père Lachaise was a place where I put one foot in front of the other, where all my remembering had to happen, and in that moving slowly forward, a forgetting could follow, or rather, things began to feel smaller because of their distance. Walking, looking at stones, veils, memories, chagrin, and thinking about the finitude of bad feelings. François Laruelle now has Parkinson's, and he no longer speaks. He spends silent days in Cité des Musiciens, a home for retired musicians and artists in Paris. They have a baby grand piano there in the dining hall. The French understand these things. When I last saw François, I showed him a photo of a snake I made from clay. This piece, called Table Snake Mantelpiece, is in the collection of the Arts Council of Ireland. I told him how proud I was that they had bought it. I spoke to him about the Linnea Serpentinata, about the snake as coiled potential, as a symbol of protection and healing, something finite and something eternal in one, an Ouroboros, a living Mobius strip, like time. The clay's sedimentary nature, a souvenir from another world, from another continent, something from home, something from the motherland. All these things contained inside one mud-made body. My friend François looked at me and looked at the photo of my clay snake on my phone and smiled.
Rêver un impossible rêve, porter le chagrin des départs, brûler d'une possible fièvre.
Near where we live, work has started on new apartments in place of some abandoned buildings. Last weekend, the site was left with the inside face of the three-story high rear wall open to the town. Floors and walls removed. A checker of wallpaper and paint. Pale areas where paintings or furniture were. High up, a toilet roll holder with its last pink banner fluttering in the breeze. Elsewhere, a postcard stuck to a wall at what was once bed height. I know what Annie Ernaux meant when she wrote, "Amongst all the beliefs I don't seek to rid myself of, there is this one. Houses maintain the memory of what took place there." One of the unusual features of our species is that we make our habitat. And all of us are involved. Small acts of repair, cultivation and removal. Adjustments. Our desires and needs writ large in the world lead to bigger changes. We live our daily lives in the residues of others, and we can read their stories if minded to. The ivy-clouded lump of the workhouse, the stark loom of a convent, corrugations rusted to lace on a Dutch barn, the fading dots and lines of COVID. We see it too in our homes, the rigid Victorian layouts for more ordered families, serried chimneys of workers' terraces, dash and ebullient gardens from early social housing estates. The big house, plump with colonial wealth, that survived by its usefulness, becoming tenements, then flats, then offices. Our towns are both archives and laboratories. We live in memory. Each year, I run a summer school in architecture for 15-year-olds. In one exercise, The students are spaced at intervals in the small town where we are based. They have an hour to draw the street and the buildings between one another. Later, these drawings are assembled into a collaged map on the floor of a local gallery. We start the conversation by asking how long the drawing took to make. The students mention the hour before it's realised that as there were 40 of them, the drawing actually took a working week. Then we start working out the age of the drawn buildings. Some are new, some are centuries old. We add this time up. We notice that some hold ideas from the place and others from far away. The town serves equally those who have lived there for generations and us, who are only there for a week. We talk about the ways it supports life and when it does not. We notice the wear of weather and countless hands and feet in smooth stone and bowed steps. We talk about the lives led, the people who have interacted, moments both banal and extraordinary. All those countless durations are added, years become centuries, millennia, and keep going. Then we talk about how the buildings were made, the time it took for trees to grow, stone to be shaped, brought together and assembled. We talk about practicality, beauty, and empathy. Over time, the materials used to build change, and we think about how this tracks bigger changes in the world. We notice the robustness of some, the fragility of others, and talk about maintenance, about buildings as something we tend. Our calculation of time ticks ever upward, all hypothetical but capturing a truth. There are millions of years of time baked into even small towns. We build for ourselves, but also for countless others who we will never know. A profound affirmation. We grow up knowing our cultures are built on many lives, a conversation in space and matter, in the memories held by rooms. We end the exercise by working out how long it took to design each building. Some were designed in the act of making. Others were designed once and built many times. Others are bespoke. What is clear is that each hour in imagining a building shapes centuries of labour, inhabitation and experience. We are building a lot now, and we will have to for some time. We hear a lot about how to pay and how fast to build. Strange we do not talk more about what we are building. Our country, in poorer times, had more ambition in making public buildings, but now rarely thinks it can ask for anything more than competence. As our population grows past the tide line of famine, it might be good to leave something that speaks of more than crisis. We might dare ask for excellence. Rather than achieving speed by cutting design time, we can make sure that the widest mix of designers share the load. We can make practical, intelligent, and varied housing that works beautifully now and which acts as a gift to future inhabitants who we will never meet, but who will know us by what we leave them.
I have never been to France. Our single holiday, during my childhood, was 2 weeks in Portneuf, a half hour's drive from home. We were there, in the sweeping rain, on August 16th, 1977. Dad ducked his head into our caravan, shaking raindrops, and announced that Elvis Presley was dead. Mum twiddled the dials on her radio. Out of the interference, thundered Elvis's voice. Over the next hour, that cramped space filled with hound dogs, jailhouses, blue moons and lonesomeness. Halfway into my raincoat, I slipped out the door. Walking across the site, towards the beach, Elvis leaked from every second caravan. Marie's caravan was silent and in darkness. She and I had been friends for a week. Marie was born 2 years before me making her a worldly 12. She was French and played flute in a junior orchestra and seemingly breezed through competitions. Her family were leaving Donegal the next morning. I was hoping to see her one last time. This holiday emits a glow across the years, possibly because it's still the only time I've been on holiday. The last time I was outside Ireland was in 1989. My girlfriend, Paula, and I were painting students at the National College of Art and Design. Towards the end of that academic year, we were evicted from our bedsit. Happy to say goodbye to the dancing mice, we still faced the problem of where to live for the summer. Feeling the need of a break from rodents, rising damp, faulty appliances, and burglaries, we hopped aboard a train out of Dublin. From the deck of the ferry, we watched Larne disappear. By nightfall, we would be in the city of my birth, Glasgow, two waifs turning up on the doorstep of my godmother aunt. My parents, around the time of the first moon landing, and not much older than me now on this ferry crossing, had crossed in the opposite direction, carrying the precious bundle of their firstborn child. For the Donegal immigrant community that established itself in Glasgow during the dawning years of the 20th century, this was much trafficked and sometimes mournful water. The young art student arriving in Scotland, of course, had no memories from his first year of life. The wonder that I was no longer in Ireland intensified on the city-bound train from Stranraer. Humdrum Scottish countryside burst into ballads of hope in the summer twilight. Unable to find work, Paula had the sunny idea that we might try our hands at pavement art, which I at first resisted. Down to our last few pounds, I balked at the price of chalks. Paula reasoned, not for the first time, that the one thing we had going for us was that we could turn bits of charcoal or paint into things that people would take the time to look at. Soon, we found ourselves on busy shopping streets, surrounded by people looking and taking photographs and talking to us about art. Paula joked that we'd become tourist attractions. I said back that she was certainly attractive enough. The big money spinners, we found, were the French Impressionists. Of these, the artist who inspired the heaviest flow of coins, interspersed with the odd banknote, was Renoir. On Saturdays, a busker in a fine suit would set up a spinet piano on Buchanan Street. The music drifting through the shoppers had a magical effect on our drawings, directly opposite the pianist on the thoroughfare. Our dancers at Le Moulin de la Galette became more animated. Our sailboats on the Seine in luncheon of the boating party seemed lighter on the light-filled water. One afternoon, I heard a snippet of music I recognised. "A wee French air," answered the busker when I inquired. "Satie, j'aime n'a pas dit number one." After Portneuf, Marie and I had exchanged letters for 18 months. One package contained a cassette, my lost friend playing Satie on flute. I have never applied for a passport, yet painting has perhaps given me an alternative travel permit. En plein air is a French term meaning in the open air. For more than a decade, I have been painting outdoors in the same small area of West Donegal where my childhood days unfolded. The first plein air painters revolutionised art by the simple act of capturing light on location in places like Normandy. I have not seen the world. As an artist, however, I am deeply observing this world within walking distance. During the COVID-19 lockdowns, Paula and our two young children, Cornelia and Lucian, began learning and fell in love with the French language. Paula bought books, CDs, and set up Duolingo accounts. On hill slopes with my French box easel, painting the sea, I'd hear them passing on their walks. Le papillon de nuit? Moth. L'étoile? Star. Le coquillage? Seashell.
On the hill above Quarto, a suburb of the city of Genoa, stands the ex manicomio, the former psychiatric hospital. I went there for what is called the presentation of my most recent novel. It may seem a strange idea to launch a book in an ex-asylum, but this place is different. A vast complex of what are called Liberty period buildings, all individual structures built around central gardens, each standing independent of the others, painted in those faded yellows, golds and ochres, characteristic of the finest buildings of the Italian Riviera. High windows, ornate stucco work, painted ceilings inside. This could be some sort of early 20th century Mar-a-Lago, a fashionable gated community for the Italian bourgeoisie. Instead, it was the saddest of places, sadder even perhaps than a graveyard, because here, people were committed for all those reasons we are familiar with in Ireland, and so many were then lost to their families and to society, entombed among the unhappy and subjected to terrible treatments that often only made things worse and at best were terrifying in themselves. Like all of the big psychiatric institutions of Italy, it was closed by one man. That man was Franco Basaglia, a legendary name in psychiatric history. Even as a student, he was shocked by the asylum system. But when he took up his first position as a doctor in the asylum of Gorizia, he observed at first hand that the system was designed to deprive people of their liberty, expropriate their physical being for experimental treatments, subject them to brutal isolation, and to effectively punish them for what was, in the end of the day, an illness that few knew anything about. Physical abuse, straitjackets, ice packs, bed ties, ECT and insulin coma shock therapies were all part of the battery of treatments he rejected. He noted how many books and articles on human psychology were based on the behaviour of patients in psychiatric hospitals and argued trenchantly that a good deal of the clinical description of madness was actually caused by the institution itself and its treatments. The asylum institution, he wrote, has in itself, in its violent, coercive, discriminating character, a secret social and political function. The mentally ill, hospitalized and destroyed in our asylums do not reveal themselves only as the object of violence of an institution dedicated to defend the sane from madness, not just the objects of violence in a society that rejects mental illness, but at the same time, they are the poor and the dispossessed who, precisely because they lack the capacity to oppose this violence, fall to the mercy of the institution appointed to control them. Basaglia founded an association called Democratic Psychiatry, which successfully lobbied for the closure of the great institutions and the transfer of treatment of mental illness from the psychiatric to the medical hospitals and to what became known as treatment in the community. The law passed in 1978, which put this into effect, is still today known as Basaglia's Law, La Legge Basaglia, in his honour. And today, as a result of Basaglia's activism, the ex manicomio di Quarto, as it is called, hosts, among other things, an art and cultural centre where book launches, concerts and exhibitions take place. It has a vast collection of art, some of it by famous contemporary Italian artists and some by former patients, all of it displayed without names, because, as the director told me, art is art, whether it is created by a well-known artist or an unknown psychiatric patient. On the day of my book launch, there is also a photographic exhibition by my friend Patrizia Traverso, a series of beautiful architectural images of the asylum itself, coupled with poetry by ex-patients. One image of clouds moving through a blue sky over the asylum has the lines, "They speed across the sky. It seems that someone is following them." When I tell the director that I find the place sad, he admonishes me. "Yes," he says, "once it was sad, but now it is a place of inspiration, a happy place." There are still some patients here, though they are now called residents. They are those for whom the institution became indispensable and who chose to remain when the hospital was dissolved. They have apartments here and can leave whenever they like. They're looked after by a specialist team, and some help out in the dining room where our reception is held. Some attend the book launch. Others watch from outside the window. They greet us like old friends. Afterwards, we emerge into the sunset and look down on the town of Quarto. Its official title is Quarto dei Mille, Quarto of the Thousand, because it is from here in 1860 that Garibaldi set off with his 1,000 red shirts to conquer Sicily and begin the final phase of the unification of his country. Who knows if it had gone against him or if conditions had been different, some well-meaning doctor might have certified Garibaldi as insane. After all, who could imagine anyone unifying a country so diverse and so divided with a mere 1,000 men? Were they not all mad? In another time, he might have ended up here in the ex-manicomio of Quarto, awaiting his own liberation by the great psychiatric liberator, Franco Basaglia.
Monet restored. Under the microscope, micro-movement. Sized and raw, linen threads fine as filament have warp and weft, stretched and drawn, to suit your gaping scars of argentile with argent. And the single sailboat sails, belly again, with fearless air. And the jagged, ragged lacerations are grafted to stipple this basin of the Seine with impressions of light. Impressions of autumnal colour, rivering once more, reflections of trees. And on the horizon, the town's inhabitants are awakening from a desperate dream. But looking out, they see the scene, dappled water, falling light, opalescent sky, and Monet, mindful, on his lapping boat, cataracts scalpeled from his eyes, sight restored, canvas propped against the gunwale, sable brush raised, poised, serene.
On this morning's programme you heard Matisse by Judith Mock from the programme archive. The Myth, the Legend and the Facts was by Kathy Power. Sediment, Snake, Cat in a Paris Library by Alice Recab. Affirmation was by Andrew Clancy. A Wee French Air by Cornelius Brown. Basaglia's Law was by William Wall. And Monet Restored, a poem by Cyril Kelly, also from the programme archive. The music was theme music from Barry Lyndon, performed by the Chieftains. The theme from Lion Boy by Rick Hart. La Quête, sung by Jacques Brel. Wigwam by Bob Dylan. Gymnopédie, number 1, by Satie, performed by Julie Skolnick on flute and Jason Vio on guitar. The Arrival of Man from Black in the Earth, performed by its composer Adele O'Dwyer on cello, with Joanna Petkukolan on violin, Dermot Dunn on accordion and Bernard Riley on percussion. This morning's Sunday Miscellany was produced by Cleonani Onlune, and the broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.